Michael Herzog, coming to you live from the Valley of the Sun on this Tuesday, March the 20th, 2018, edition of the American Awakening. Before I get started today, I want to again remind everyone that tomorrow I'm going to have Dr. Kevin Barrett up in the second hour to share from his perspective, from his boots on the ground in Iran perspective, his findings regarding Iran's people, their religious affiliations, their culture, their leadership, and his thoughts on how they seemingly all have a tendency to live in peace, unlike the division constantly foisted upon the Western world. And also, I want to touch on the Iranian law with Kevin regarding arresting women not wearing a burqa or a hijab or whatever you call it over there, and their laws on homosexuality. Now, again, Thursday, first hour is going to be Rudy Davis. I'm going to interview. He's an advocate for political prisoners, and he's the guy that made that YouTube video that I aired with you folks last week. And also, he has written to James Wesley Howell in his incarceration over there in Los Angeles. And then in the second hour, we're going to hear from Henry Macau regarding his writings on Howell and how he came across the story and likely some other topics. But then Friday, folks, and this ties in with what I'm going to share today. What happened to the passengers? And riding co-pilot with me Friday will be Daryl in Alabama, a fellow pilot, as you know, an aeronautical expert. Well, at least if you compare him to me. Wherein 3,000 of our brothers and sisters died horrifically in the furtherance of the Zionist agenda, as well as likely covering up for the real cause of death of the four flights on that fateful day. And I wish to remind all of you, all of the events, the false flags, the wars of aggression, the incursions of our civil rights, they all hinge upon the lie, or slash lies, of 9/11. Hence, as much as it pains us to revisit, we must understand that this event was the turning point in our once great republic. And it is also, as my friend Daryl in Alabama opined, the linchpin by which the floodgates of truth can open, should we all be brave enough, in light of overwhelming adversity, to stand our ground. Now, I started yesterday to give you the top 10 myths about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and my computer went on the fritz. Well, hopefully it's fixed, I think. So I'm going to give you the last six. Then we're going to move on to my report today on what I call the PNAC boys. So let's get started with the with myth number five. The Arab nations threatened Israel with annihilation in 1967 and again in 1973. Now, I heard the interview yesterday with Michael Rivero where he interviewed Joe, what's his name, regarding the USS Liberty. You know, if those folks are such great friends of ours and great allies, why would they bomb our ship? Well, we all know the answer to that, to drag America into this fight against Egypt. But with friends like that, who needs enemies? The fact of the matter is that it was Israel that fired the first shot of the Six-Day War. Early on the morning of June 5th, Israel launched fighters in a surprise attack on Egypt, then the United Arab Republic, and successfully decimated the Egyptian Air Force while most of his planes were still on the ground. It is virtually obligatory for this attack to be described by commentators today as preemptive. But to have been preemptive by definition, folks, there must have been an imminent threat of Egyptian aggression against Israel. Yet, well, there wasn't one. Interesting. It is commonly claimed that President Nasser's bellicose rhetoric, blockade of the Straits of Tehran, movement of troops into the Sinai Peninsula, and expulsion of UN peacekeeping forces from its side of the border collectively constituted such an imminent threat. Yet, both the United States and Israeli intelligence assessed at the time that the likelihood Nasser would actually attack was very low. The CIA assessed that Israel had overwhelming superiority in force and arms and would, in the event of a war, defeat the Arab forces within 2 weeks. Within a week if Israel attacked first, which is what actually occurred. Now, It must be kept in mind that Egypt had been the victim of aggression by the British, the French, and Israelis in the 1956 Suez Crisis, following Egypt's nationalization of the Suez Canal. And in that war, folks, the three aggressor nations conspired to wage war upon Egypt, which resulted in the Israeli occupation of the Sinai Peninsula. And under United States pressure, Israel withdrew from the Sinai in 1957. But Egypt had not forgotten the Israeli aggression. And moreover, Egypt had formed a loose alliance with Syria and Jordan, with each pledging to come to the aid of the others in the event of a war with Israel. So Jordan had criticized Nasser for not living up to that pledge after the Israeli attack on the West Bank village of Samu the year before, and his rhetoric was a transparent attempt to regain face in the Arab world. That Nasser's positioning was defensive rather than projecting an intent to wage an offensive war against Israel, as well recognized among prominent Israelis. As Avraham Saleh of the Shalem Center has observed, and I quote, "The Egyptian buildup in Sinai lacked a clear offensive plan, and Nasser's defensive instructions explicitly assumed an Israeli first strike," unquote. And Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin acknowledged that in June of 67, we again had a choice. "The Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack them." Yitzhak Rabin, who would also later become Prime Minister of Israel, admitted in 1968 that, and I quote, "I do not think Nasser wanted war. The two divisions he sent to the Sinai would not have been sufficient to launch an offensive." He knew it, and we knew it. Israelis have also acknowledged that their own rhetoric at the time about the threat of annihilation from the Arab states was pure propaganda. And General, get this, folks, Chaim Herzog, commanding general and first military, and first military governor of the occupied West Bank following the war, admitted that there was no longer a danger of annihilation, and Israeli headquarters never believed in this danger. General Ezer Weizman similarly said, and I quote, "There was never a danger of extermination. This hypothesis had never been considered in any serious meeting." And Chief of Staff Chaim Bar-Lev acknowledged, and I quote, "We were not threatened with genocide on the eve of the Six-Day War, and we never thought of such a possibility," unquote. And Israeli Minister of Housing Mordecai Bentov has also acknowledged that, and I quote, "The entire story of danger of extermination was invented," get that, folks, "invented in every detail and exaggerated a posteriori to justify the annexation of new Arab territory. And in 1973, in what Israel is called the Yom Kippur War, Egypt and Syria launched a surprise offensive to retake the Sinai and the Golan Heights, respectively. And this joint action is popularly described in contemporaneous accounts as an invasion or an act of aggression against Israel. No, they just tried to take it back. That wasn't aggression. They just wanted back what Israel had taken from them. Yet, as already noted, following the June 67 war, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 242, calling upon Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. And Israel, needless to say, refused to do so, and has remained in perpetual violation of international law ever since. So ask yourself this question. How do they continually get away with this? They do it with the support of our nation, the United States of America, and all their butt-kissing leadership in that domain. During the 1973 war, Egypt and Syria thus invaded their own territory, then under illegal occupation by Israel, and it's turned around and blamed on them. I see. The corollary of the description of this war was an act of Arab aggression implicitly assumes that the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip were Israeli territory. And this is, needless to say, folks, a grossly false assumption that demonstrates the absolutely prejudicial and biased nature of mainstream commentary when it comes to the Israel-Arab conflict. And this false narrative fits in with the larger overall narrative, equally fallacious, of Israel as the victim of Arab intransigence and aggression. This narrative, largely unquestioned in the West, flips reality on its head. Myth number six. Have I got your attention yet, folks? The UN Security Council Resolution 242 called only for a partial Israeli withdrawal. Folks, Resolution 242 was passed in the wake of the June 67 war and called for the withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. And while the above argument enjoys widespread popularity, it has no merit whatsoever. The central thesis of the argument is that the absence of the word "the" before occupied territories in that clause means not all of the occupied territories were intended. Essentially, this argument rests upon the ridiculous logic that because the word "the" was omitted from the clause, well, we may therefore understand this to mean that some of the occupied territories was the intended meaning. Now, grammatically, the absence of the word "the" has no effect on the meaning of the clause, which refers to territories, plural. A simple litmus test question is it territory that was occupied by Israel in the 1964 or 67 war? And if yes, then under international law and Resolution 242, Israel is required to withdraw from that territory. And such territories include the Syrian Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. Now, the French version of the resolution, equally authentic as the English, contains the definite article, and the majority of the members of the Security Council made clear during deliberations that their understanding of the resolution was that it would require Israel to fully withdraw from all occupied territories. And additionally, it is impossible to reconcile with the principle of international law cited in the preamble to the resolution of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. To say that the UN intended that Israel could retain some of the territory it occupied during the war, it would fly in the face of this cited principle. And one could go on to address various other logical fallacies associated with this frivolous argument, but as absurd as it is on its face, it would be superfluous to do so. Myth number 7. The Israeli military action against its neighbors is only taken to defend itself against terrorism. Not. The facts, folks, tell another story. I mean, take, for instance, the devastating 1982 Israeli war with Lebanon. Now, as political analyst Noam Chomsky extensively documents in his epic analysis, quote, "The Fateful Triangle," unquote, this military offensive was carried out with barely even the thinnest veil of a pretext. And while one may read contemporary accounts insisting this war was fought in response to a constant shelling of northern Israel by the PLO, then based in Lebanon, by the way, the truth is that despite continuous Israeli provocations, the PLO had, with only a few exceptions, folks, abided by a ceasefire that had been in place. And moreover, in each of these or those instances, it was Israel that had first violated the ceasefire. And among Israeli provocations throughout early 1982, it attacked and sank Lebanese fishing boats and otherwise committed hundreds of violations of Lebanese territorial waters. It committed thousands of violations of Lebanese airspace, yet never did manage to provoke the PLO response it sought to serve as the casus belli for the planned invasion of Lebanon. And on May 9th, Israel bombed Lebanon, an act that was finally met with the PLO response when it launched rocket and artillery fire into Israel. Then, a terrorist group headed by Abu Nidal attempted to assassinate Israeli Ambassador Shlomo Argov in London. And although the PLO itself had been at war with Abu Nidal, who had been condemned to death by a Fatah military tribunal in 1973, and despite the fact that Abu Nidal was not based in Lebanon, Israel cited this event as a pretext to bomb the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, killing 200 Palestinians. And the PLO responded by shelling settlements in northern Israel. Yet Israel did not manage to provoke the kind of larger-scale response it was looking to use as the casus belli for its planned invasion. So as Israeli scholar Yahushua Porath had suggested, Israel's decision to invade Lebanon, far from being a response to PLO attacks, rather flowed from the very fact that the ceasefire had been observed. Writing in the Israel Daily Herex, Peretz assessed that the government's hope is that the stricken PLO, lacking a logistic and territorial base, will return to its earlier terrorism. In this way, the PLO will lose part of the political legitimacy that it had gained, undercutting the danger that elements will develop among Palestinians that might become a legitimate negotiating partner for future political accommodations. As another example, folks, take Israel's Operation Cast Lead from December 27, 2008 to January 18, 2009. Now, prior to Israel's assault on the besieged and defenseless population of the Gaza Strip, remember the ones that throw rocks and get arrested and do 10 years in prison for that? Israel had entered into a ceasefire agreement with the governing authority there and Hamas. Contrary to popular myth, it was Israel, not Hamas, who ended the ceasefire. And the pretext for Operation Cast Lead is obligatorily described in Western media accounts as being the thousands of rockets that Hamas had been firing into Israel prior to the offensive in violation of the ceasefire. Well, the truth is that from the start of the ceasefire in June until November 4th, Hamas had no fire. They had fired no rockets at all, despite numerous provocations from Israel, including stepped-up operations in the West Bank and Israeli soldiers taking pop shots at Gazans across the border, resulting, by the way, in several injuries and at least one death. So on November the 4th, it was again Israel who violated the ceasefire with airstrikes and a ground invasion of Gaza that resulted in further deaths, and Hamas finally responded with rocket fire. And from that point on, the ceasefire was effectively over, with daily tit-for-tat attacks from both sides. And despite Israel's lack of good faith, Hamas offered to renew the ceasefire from the time it was set to officially expire in December. And Israel rejected the offer, preferring instead to inflict violent collective punishment on the people of Gaza. And as the Israeli Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center noted, the truce brought relative quiet to a Western Negev population with 329 rockets and mortar attacks, most of them during the month and a half between November 4th, when Israel had violated and effectively ended the truce. Now, this stands in remarkable contrast to the 2,278 rocket and mortar attacks in the 6 months prior to the truce. Until November 4th, the center also observed Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. Now, folks, if Israel had desired to continue to mitigate the threat of Palestine militant rocket attacks, it would have simply not ended the ceasefire, which was very highly effective in reducing the number of such attacks, including eliminating all such attacks by Hamas. It would not have instead resorted to violence, predictably resulting in a greatly escalated threat of retaliatory rocket and mortar attacks from Palestinian militant groups. Moreover, even if Israel could claim that peaceful means had been exhausted and that a resort to military force to act in self-defense to defend its civilian population was necessary, that this demonstrably was not what occurred. Instead, Israel deliberately targeted the civilian population of Gaza with systematic and deliberate, disproportionate and indiscriminate attacks on residential areas, hospitals, schools, and other locations with protected civilian status under international law. Not done yet. Gonna get better.
I'm getting older and noticing that my body just doesn't work as well as it used to. So I like to keep fit as possible by hitting the gym a few times a week. Recently, I started having a nagging bicep pain and it got so bad I couldn't even lift the weights. When I was complaining about it to a friend, he told me about Angioprim. He said chelation helps remove toxins, heavy metals, and cholesterol in veins and arteries that may cause blockages. You know, after just 1 week of taking Angioprim, the pain was gone and now I'm back in the gym full strength. Scientific research proves the active ingredient in Angioprim has superior oral chelation action that helps promote cardiovascular health. So to learn more, go to angioprim.com. That's Angioprim.com. Or talk to a trained consultant. Call Angioprim toll free at 877-882-7221. You'll feel better with more energy. Call 877-882-7221 or go to the website angioprim.com.
know there is an ongoing war right here in America? Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
Right, folks, I won't back down. Don't you just love the government of this country, the Israeli government? Oh, yeah. And the butt-kissing that goes on in our government to these people? As a respected journalist and an international jurist who headed up the United Nations investigation into the assault, Richard Goldstone had observed, the means by which Israel carried out Operation Cast Lead were not consistent with its stated aims, but was rather more indicative of a deliberate act of collective punishment of the civilian population. Myth number 8. God gave the land to the Jews, so the Arabs are the occupiers. Folks, no amount of discussion of the facts on the ground will ever convince many Jews and Christians that Israel could ever do wrong, because they view its actions as having the hand of God behind it, and that its policies are in fact the will of God. They believe that God gave the land to Palestine, including the West Bank and Gaza Strip, to the Jewish people, and therefore Israel has a right to take it by force from the Palestinians, who, in this view, are the wrongful occupiers of the land. But one may simply turn to the pages of their own holy books to demonstrate the fallaciousness of this or similar beliefs. Christian Zionists are fond of quoting passages from the Bible, such as the following, to support their Zionist beliefs. And Yahweh said to Abraham, after Lot had separated from him, and I quote, lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see I give to you and your descendants forever. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants could also be numbered. Arise and walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you. That's in Genesis 13:14-17. And then Yahweh appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in the land, and I will be with you and bless you, for to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham and your father, Genesis 26:1-3. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, I am Yahweh, God of Abraham, your father, and God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants, Genesis 28:13. Yet Christian Zionists conveniently disregard other passages providing further context for understanding this covenant, such as the following, and I'll get to that in a minute. Let's first go to Peter in Los Angeles. Peter, you're on with Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, Michael. First off, did you get the articles I sent you that talking about how Obama turned over all of our intercepts on American citizens to Israel?
Yes, I did.
Good, good. That's a really important thing. I want to let you know that Abu Nidal was found later to be and was admitted to be an Israeli agent. And that was after he did the Achille Roro and pushed off a Jewish guy in a wheelchair named Leon Klinghoffer. But he was a Israeli agent. That's number one. Number two, Hamas was invented by the Israelis. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, Palestinian mayors of small towns were starting to coalesce into an organized movement in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. And so the Israelis, started up Hamas as a controlled opposition to these mayors, who then they started to assassinate these mayors. They started killing the mayors. But then they started up Hamas, and then Hamas, of course, morphed out of their control because, you know, not even, you know, anybody, you just can't be for them and be Palestinian. The Israelis are so cruel and horrible. What else I was going to say? I'd love to tell you sometime about the War College report on the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 2006. If you have time, I'd love to go over that.
Sure. Why don't you give your contact information to my engineer, Dan, and we'll discuss it off the air.
All right. Sounds like a winner. Right, well, can you switch me back, and I'd be happy to do that.
Yeah, go ahead and pick him up, Dan, and get his contact information from him, Peter in Los Angeles. All right. Thank you. Yeah, so anyway, continuing with this, I'm going to go to a break here shortly. But it goes on to say in Leviticus, "You shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments and perform them, that the land where I am bringing you to dwell may not vomit you out." We'll be back in a few minutes. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening. I'm on my pulpit now, preaching to you in the pews, folks. Be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AROutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AROutfitting.com.
Well, it's all right, riding around in the breeze. Well, it's all right, if you live the life you please. Well, it's all right, doing the best you can. Well, it's all right, as long as you lend a hand.
Hey, folks, we're back. As long as I lend a hand and I'm doing the best I can and all that good stuff. But now, see, now this is the part of the Bible that they... well, conveniently omit. They don't want to talk about this part, folks, because what it says is, and this, you know, the Israelis going, oh, the Bible says that we got the land back. We're taking it away from you. You're going to mow you down with a bulldozer like Rachel Corrie. Okay. But what they omit is, listen to this, folks. But if you do not obey me and do not observe all these commandments, but break my covenant, I will bring the land to desolation, and your enemies who dwell in it shall be astonished at it. I will scatter you among the nations and draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. You shall perish among the nations and the land of your enemies and shall eat you up. That was Leviticus 26, 14, 15, 32, 33, and 28. Therefore, Yahweh was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight, and there was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria. And it is to this day. That's in 2 Kings 17, 18, and 23. And I said, after Israel had done all these things, return to me. But she did not return. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And then I saw that for all of the causes for which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a certificate of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but went and played the harlot also. Jeremiah 3, 7 and 8. Yes. In the Bible, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, told the Hebrews that the land could be theirs. Yes, they did. If, folks, the big if they would obey his commandments. Yet, as the Bible tells the story, the Hebrews were rebellious against Yahweh in all of their generations. Now, what Jewish and Christian Zionists omit from their biblical arguments in favor of continued Israeli occupation is that Yahweh also told the Hebrews, including the tribe of Judah, from whom the Jews are descended, that he would remove them from the land if they broke the covenant by rebelling against his commandments, which is precisely what occurs in the Bible. Thus, The theological argument for Zionism is not only bunk from the secular point of view, but it's also a wholesale fabrication from a scriptural perspective, representing a continued rebelliousness against Yahweh and his Torah, and the teachings of Yeshua and Messiah, Jesus the Christ, in the New Testament. Do I have your attention yet? Myth number 9. The Palestinians reject the two-state solution because they want to destroy Israel. Not. In an enormous concession to Israel, Palestinians have long accepted the two-state solution. The elected representatives of the Palestinian people in Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Liberation Organization had, since the 1970s, folks, recognized the state of Israel and accepted the two-state solution to the conflict. And despite this, Western media continued throughout the 90s to report that the PLO rejected the solution and instead wanted to wipe Israel off the map. The pattern has been repeated since Hamas was voted into power in 2006 in Palestinian elections, and although Hamas has for years accepted the reality of the state of Israel and demonstrated a willingness to accept a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip alongside Israel, it is virtually obligatory for Western mainstream media, even today, to report that Hamas rejects the two-state solution, that it instead seeks to destroy Israel. In fact, in early 2004, shortly before he was assassinated by Israel, by the way, Hamas founder Sheikh Ahmed Yassin said that Hamas could accept a Palestinian state alongside Israel. And Hamas has since repeatedly reiterated its willingness to accept a two-state solution. And in early 2005, Hamas issued a document stating its goal of seeking a Palestinian state alongside Israel and recognizing the 1967 borders. What more can you do, folks? The exiled head of the political bureau of Hamas, Khalid Mashai, wrote in the London Guardian in January 2006 that Hamas was ready to make a just peace. And he wrote that we shall never recognize the right of any power to rob us of our land and deny us of our national rights. But if you are willing to accept the principles of a long-term truce, we are prepared to negotiate the terms. And during the campaigning for the 2006 elections, the top Hamas officials in Gaza, Mahmoud al-Zahar, said that Hamas was ready to accept the establishment of our independent state of the area occupied in 1967, a tacit recognition of the state of Israel. The elected prime minister from Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, said in February of 2006 that Hamas accepted the establishment of the Palestinian state within the 1967 borders. And in April of 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter met with Hamas officials and afterwards stated that Hamas would accept a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders and would accept the right of Israel to live as a neighbor next door in peace. And it was Hamas' ultimate goal to see Israel living in their allocated borders, the 1967 borders, and a contiguous, vital Palestinian state alongside. And that same month, Hamas leader Mashal said, and I quote, "We have offered a truce if Israel withdraws to the 1967 borders, a truce of 10 years as a proof of recognition," unquote. In 2009, Mashal said that Hamas has accepted a Palestinian state with the 1967 borders. Hamas' shift in policy away from total rejection of the existence of the state of Israel towards acceptance of the international consensus on a two-state solution to the conflict is in no small part a reflection of the will of the Palestinian people. A public opinion survey from April of last year, for instance, found that 3 out of 4 Palestinians were willing to accept that two-state solution. So, that brings me to myth number 10. The U.S. is an honest broker. Remember, this is a myth. The U.S. is an honest broker and has sought to bring about peace in the Middle East. That one's enough to make you lose your lunch. Rhetoric aside, folks, the U.S. supports Israel's policies, including its illegal occupation and other violations of international humanitarian law. It supports Israel's criminal policies financially, your tax dollars, folks, military, and diplomatically. And the Obama administration, for example, stated publicly that it was opposed to Israel's settlements policy and ostensibly pressured Israel to freeze colonization activities. Yet, Very early on, the administration announced that it would not cut back any financial or military aid to Israel, even if it defied the international law and continued settlement construction. And that message was perfectly well understood by the Netanyahu government of Israel, which continued its colonization policies. And to cite another straightforward example, both the House, the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate passed resolutions openly declaring support for Israel's Operation Cast Lead, despite a constant stream of reports evidencing Israeli war crimes. We were supporting it, folks. On the day the U.S. Senate passed its resolution, reaffirming the United States' strong support for Israel in its battle with Hamas, January 8, 2009, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, issued a statement demanding that Israel allow it to assist the victims of the conflict because the Israeli military had blocked access to wounded Palestinians, a war crime under international law. And that same day, and by the way, hey, we're pushing them, we're behind them, folks. That same day, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a statement condemning Israel for firing on a UN aid convoy delivering humanitarian supplies to Gaza, and for the killing of two UN staff members, both further war crimes. And on that day that the House passed its own version of the resolution, the UN announced that it had to stop humanitarian work in Gaza because of numerous incidents in which its staff, its convoys, its installations, including clinics and schools, had come under Israeli attack. U.S. financial support for Israel surpasses $3 billion annually. Really, is it $10 or $20 million a day that goes over there? Your tax dollars, folks, that goes over there to kill these people. When Israel waged a war to punish the defenseless civilian population of Gaza, its pilots flew U.S.-made F-16 fighter bombers and Apache helicopter gunships, dropping U.S.-made bombs, including the use of white phosphorus. White phosphorus, you know what that is, folks? Huh? Weapon of mass destruction, munitions, in violation of international law. Not only are we pushing them, not only are we helping them, not only are they allies, we're supplying them the ammunition to do it with your tax dollars. I'm sick of this. Sick of it. The U.S. diplomatic support for Israel crimes includes its use of the veto power of the U.N. Security Council when Israel was waging a devastating war against the civilian population and infrastructure of Lebanon in the summer of 2006. The U.S. vetoed a ceasefire resolution. As Israel was waging Operation Cast Lead, the U.S. delayed the passage of a resolution calling for an end to the violence and then abstained rather than criticize Israel, and it finally allowed the resolution to be put into a vote. When the UN Human Rights Council officially adopted the findings and recommendations of its investigation into war crimes during Operation Cast Lead, headed up by Richard Goldstone, the U.S. responded by announcing its intentions to block any effort to have the Security Council similarly adopt its conclusions and recommendations. The United States Congress passed a resolution rejecting the Goldstone report because it found that Israel had committed war crimes. Though it's virtually unconditional unconditional support for Israel, the United States has effectively blocked any step to implement the two-state solution to the Israel-Palestinian conflict. So we are honest brokers? The so-called peace process has for many decades consisted of the United States and Israel rejection of Palestine's self-determination and blocking of any viable Palestinian state. And we're supposed to be the referee. We're the mediator, folks. Who are we really? Who runs this government? How many people of dual citizenship occupy seats in that government? I'm getting to that. Give me a minute. I'm going to catch my breath. Folks, there are countries around our earthly domain that hold America's previous leaders accountable and have indeed found them guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. And isn't it funny that George W. Bush canceled a trip to Switzerland for a speech? Or, by the way, let him try to land in Malaysia or Indonesia, because these countries recognize war crimes and have convicted him, along with Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, of such. Iran and Syria, they do not house nor do they recognize a Zionist banking system, nor do they desire it. There is no need in their respective economies. Ask yourselves, why would they wish to succumb to a usurial bloodsucker. They wouldn't. Just as Saddam Hussein and just as Muammar Gaddafi. Saddam decided to trade oil for euros, and Gaddafi wanted to trade it with his African heads of state with a gold dinar. And sadly for both, they farted in the Rockefeller spacesuit. They diarrheaed in the Rothschild punch bowl. They threw a booger in the Warburg caviar. And we saw the result. How dare they? They're now dead. And look at the result. And we also saw, other than any ethics, any empathy, any rationale or pragmatism, our leaders demonized them to the point of expulsion, emphasized only by a Hillary witch-like cackle, resonating in the mind of all empathetic human beings as demonic. Dan, if you're there, I know Dan's having some not medical, but he's having some health problems today. Dan, if you're there, go ahead and play that 12-second clip, if you got it, if you happen to be in the booth. If not, we'll just skip over it. Are you there?
That is the land of unconfirmed reports.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No.
Isn't that lovely? We came, we saw, he died, and she cackles like a witch at it. And Saddam's trial, it was a sham. I watched it. Ah, folks, the beauty of YouTube. I'm not even going to go into that part, for I wish not to cry during this broadcast. He was our man in the Middle East. And since we, well, our CIA, assisted him, we supported him. We provided his weapons of mass destruction. He used them on the Kurds. He used them on Iran. And we, our government, rooted him on. It wasn't until he awakened to the usury of the Zionists and the banking system, the usury and inflation that caused him to decide to trade his oil in euros, when the alarm went off. And the Western puppets of the Rothschild shite in their diapers when they had to take him out. And folks, thank you. Because of you and this show, I've learned so much more about Muammar Gaddafi since I did a show on him last year. Did you know that not only was he influential among his colleagues as an African leader, and not only was Libya considered at the time the only first world country in Africa, not only had he convinced his fellow leaders in the African nations to start trading in the African gold dinar, but he succeeded in kicking out any and all foreign military bases or influence from the country, all of Africa, turning his back on a multi-billion dollar deal with the Bechtel Corporation, but also nixing of $14 billion in contracts, of which he backed out of with French Prime Minister Sarkozy, as he had not only determined to rid Africa and Western Zionist influence, but to show his fellow African leaders that they didn't need the West to make Africa into a prosperous nation. He had planned to run irrigation lines to different parts of Africa and turn desert into fertile growing land for farming. He planned to completely utilize Africa and show that they too could become a first world nation. In the Zionist agenda to divide, to weaken and conquer, isn't it hard to see why Muammar Gaddafi was a thorn in the side of the West? Because he definitively didn't fit into their plan. Hence, he had to be taken out. And we see these demonizations on Saddam in 1990, prior to Desert Storm, with the fake incubator baby story. And it's starting in 2002 with the weapons of mass destruction lie that got Susan Lindauer locked up in jail for a year, trying to, you know, defuse that one. And then again in 2010, 2011, with an alleged human rights violation who had both a love for this country, his people, and continent, and wanted to prove Africa self-sufficient. And then again, we see the same playbook foisted out, spewing more lies about Bashar al-Assad gassing his own people ad nauseum via mainstream TV, and are expected to accept them as the norm, trusting time after time, using the same lame playbook, that our leaders are in fact integral. They are anything but. They're prostitutes. They are whores. They are compromised. They are bought off and literally laughed at by the majority of the world. And that majority, indeed, having empathy, pride, and believing in human rights. And do you know why? Because there are countries on this planet that have leaders with a semblance of compassion and a moral compass. They've got spirituality. Our leaders are nil and defunct of such emotion, and the majority of the rest of the world knows it. We'll be right back.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Folks, I'm back with the American Awakening. Michael Herzog, your host, after I've settled down for a few minutes and taken a breath. But it's true. You know, there are countries on this planet that have leaders with a semblance of compassion, a real moral compass, you know, a spirituality. And our leaders are nil and defunct of any such emotion. They're psychopaths, and the majority of the rest of the world knows it. Which brings me to the topic of today's show. This took me a little longer than I thought, but hey, you know, speaking of immoral, empty, and non-empathetic towards anyone but their bank accounts, we've got the PNAC boys. You know, these traitorous, morally bankrupt, dual citizen sellouts, three of which actually penned the strategy for securing the realm. It was a writing called A Clean Break. Douglas Feith, Richard Pearl, and David Wormser, all folks dual U.S.-Israeli citizens, and oh, by the way, these documents were written while all three of these traitors were political underlings of the flaming Benjamin Netanyahu-Biedelbogen administration. And only later, along with their brother traitors to pin the PNAC documents, and then later, along with a number of their other colluding, traitorous, dual citizen friends, come through the revolving door of the Skull and Bones 322 secret society, morally bankrupt George W. Bush administration. And later, after participating with their traitorous brothers in arms, with both writing PNAC and preempting A Clean Break. which, by the way, I'm going to share. Now, we see page 51, paragraph 2 of the chapter Rebuilding America's Defenses, wherein it decries, "The process of transformation is likely to be a long one, save a cataclysmic and catastrophic event such as a new Pearl Harbor. This event was pre-planned, diabolically schemed and carried out September 11, 2001, killing 3,000 of our American brothers and sisters. And don't think for a moment that those signatories were the only dual citizens involved, as there was many signatories, and many of them Cyanim. What is Cyanim? You've heard that word before? Remember the first scene of The Godfather when the guy comes in thanking Marlon Brando for saving him from these thugs that were tapping his business, you know, beating him up to take money from him? And The Godfather took care of it. And at the end of that scene, he says, "There may come a day when you'll be called on to do something. That day may never come, but if it does, you'll be called on to do something." And the guy stands there in front of Marlon Brando and says, "Oh, yes, sir, anything you say." That's Cyanim. That's Larry Silverstein. Trump's good friend, by the way, by his own admission, folks. He leased those buildings knowing that there was massive lawsuit in play and that all the asbestos in both buildings had to be replaced. Silverstein knew it. Negotiated for a double indemnity deal with several reinsurers and insurance companies on the buildings and profited immensely by their devastation. These Jews and dual citizenry. And where does their loyalty really lie? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Douglas Feith, David Worms, Richard Pearl, Elliot Abrams, Larry Silverstein, Frank Loy, Paul Wolfowitz. Paul Wolfowitz. In this clown's Wikipedia writings, it states, and I quote, by him. I'll quote it after the break. Top of the hour coming up. Give me a couple more minutes to calm down. Be right back.
I'm through with doubt. There's nothing left for me to figure out. I've paid a price. And I'll keep paying. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down. I'm still mad as hell, and I don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. I probably wouldn't if I could. 'Cause I'm mad as hell, can't bring myself to do what it is you think I.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers, have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.